Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Much is being reported about the controversies surrounding Roy Moore in his bid for the Senate. Seriously, one could not have invented someone more holier than thou in any work of apocalyptic fiction. He is indeed a piece of work. So, for many of us, the idea of a man in his 30s dating young teens is, well, kind of creepy at best. But he still has a tremendous groundswell of support. Now, we're taping this program a bit before the election, so that by the time you hear this, the political process will have played out, and Alabama will either have surprised us all by doing, for once, the right thing, or again, finding themselves at the bottom of the list of, well, just about everything, except when Mississippi doesn't beat them to it. But regardless of the election results, Moore's alleged conduct raises a question that few have addressed. Is Moore just a potentially bad apple, or is he the product of a culture inspired by religion that encourages the kind of relationships that he may have engaged in? Today's guest seems to think this is exactly the case. She was born and raised in a milieu similar to Moore, and recently shared her thoughts in an LA Times op-ed piece that caught my eye. The headline reads, "Roy Moore's alleged pursuit of a young girl is the symptom of a larger problem in evangelical circles," and it was written by Catherine Brightbill. Catherine is our guest today. And she will share her thoughts. A little bit about Catherine. She was homeschooled from first grade through graduation from high school. Growing up in a politically active family, at one time she was the youngest ever precinct committee woman elected to her county Republican Executive Committee. She has a BA in Information and Computer Science from Covenant College, a graduate certificate in Teaching English as a Foreign Language and Intercultural Studies from Wheaton College, and her law degree is from the University of Florida. Prior to law school, she dabbled in several different fields, including spending time on the English faculty at the Diplomatic Academy of Vietnam in Hanoi, where she taught reading and writing for international relations to foreign affairs and international law students. So we welcome to Common Threads, Catherine Brightbill. Hello, Catherine.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Certainly. I'd like to talk about your homeschooling experience up top, because I noticed that in your article you refer to Homeschoolers Anonymous and a blogger by the name of Libby Ann. Homeschoolers Anonymous kind of took me by surprise. I didn't realize that homeschoolers had to have an organization in which they needed to assemble to thrive or to work out any issues. I always just thought homeschool was another option that people had for education. So tell us about your experience with homeschooling and Homeschoolers Anonymous.
Yes, my experience with homeschooling, I actually had a positive experience being homeschooled. My father has his master's degree in education and was a math teacher for a number of years. So my educational experience was positive, but I knew a number of kids who didn't have that kind of positive experience that I had, either because of educational neglect or because of child abuse that their parents were able to hide because of the isolation of homeschooling. So Several years back, a number of homeschool alumni started talking and sharing stories with each other, and realizing that those, what they'd assumed were kind of their isolated experiences in their own communities, were part of a bigger picture and a bigger story. And so several of those homeschool alumni launched the Homeschoolers Anonymous project. But shortly after it launched, I came on board as partner blogger with them. And for the first about 30 years of the modern homeschool movement, the homeschool parents were speaking and telling their stories and their side of homeschooling, but homeschool alumni didn't have a seat at the table, even though for years the story was that once kids who were homeschooled grew up, that would be the proof as to whether homeschooling was successful or not. So Homeschoolers Anonymous is formed to tell those stories, both good and bad, from the homeschool alumni perspective.
Well, obviously, as you say, you certainly must have had a positive experience because you are well-degreed in several areas. Would you say that some of these people would also claim that they did not really get an education, a quality education?
Yes, and even a number of people who are writing and speaking at homeschool alumni now about the problems in homeschooling have had to overcome the educational neglect that they received and had to fight and work to get the education, especially girls in homeschool context, related to homeschool context, tend to get a subpar education in math and science, because it's believed that it's not necessary to know algebra to be a wife and homeschool mom.
It kind of reminds me of some of the madrasas that I hear about in certain Muslim-majority countries, or even not necessarily Muslim-majority, but countries like India, where madrasas are quite popular in Muslim populations, where they focus so much on the Quran. And the same thing can be said about some of the schools, say in Israel, and possibly even here, for Hasidic Jews, that they spend all of their time focusing on the study of the Bible and the Talmud, that they can't add. They can hardly write other than as it applies to their sacred studies. So I'd not heard of that in the Christian context, but apparently this is a thing, from what you're telling me.
Yeah, it is a thing. And actually, one of the founders of Homeschoolers Anonymous tells this story about how he went to Afghanistan to teach speech and debate to students there, and realized that the students that he was teaching in Afghanistan, that he had more in common with them than he did with the mainstream American culture at his public university, because of his being raised within one of the very conservative parts of the homeschool movement.
And admittedly, you don't have to be of any particular religion to be homeschooled. As a matter of fact, I know one family who homeschooled, and they were not evangelical Christians, and they clearly did a wonderful job. Their daughter turned out to be just wonderful and very, very intelligent. But when we hear of homeschool, if somebody tells me, oh, yes, we're homeschooling, if I don't know them, perhaps it's just prejudice, but I'm going to assume, until I find out differently, that these people might be evangelical Christians of a certain ilk. And would you say that is based on at least some logic?
Yeah, I think the secular homeschoolers tend to clarify immediately that they're secular homeschoolers to distance themselves from the more religiously motivated homeschooling. So I think that is a fair statement, that if somebody's a homeschooler and doesn't distinguish that they're secular, they're likely evangelical homeschoolers. But I think it's important to note even there is that there's a range of religiously motivated homeschoolers, and that not every evangelical who's homeschooling is doing it for religious reasons. There are evangelicals who homeschool who are doing it for academic reasons and who, like the secular homeschoolers, are focusing on the academics instead, and not as much on like a religious indoctrination. So it's a there is a range there. My parents are more focused on the academics, whereas there are other families who are more focused on whether or not their children are good Christians with the academics as secondary.
Sure. And I'm also aware that there are programs to get homeschooled children out of the home for various extracurricular activities, which I can assume is quite healthy. Did you have that growing up?
I wasn't heavily involved in homeschool support groups. Largely, the homeschool support groups in my area, a lot of the kids spent most of the time talking about how they wished they were in public school. So there's that segment. They help the support homeschool support groups and extracurriculars can be very good, and I think and I would encourage families who homeschool to get involved in those. Although the other factor that people need to be careful is that a lot of those homeschool support groups are very much religiously motivated and very conservative, and once families get involved, there's a lot of peer pressure for parents to become more conservative themselves. Although there's also now opportunities in a lot of states for homeschoolers to participate in public school extracurriculars and public school sports, which is a very good way for homeschooled kids to get socialization with the rest of mainstream culture. Actually, the best most famous example of that be Tim Tebow was homeschooled and dual enrolled for to play football in public school in Florida, and then of course famously went on to the University of Florida and to win the Heisman.
Right, right. So let's get to why we brought up homeschools in the first place. But before we do that, let me just remind people that you're listening to WGVU's Common Threads. My name is Fred Stella, and with me today is Catherine Brightbill. And today we're talking about Roy Moore, the allegations against him, and how religion may or may not have played a role in all of this. So tell us how homeschooling even got into this article that you wrote for that appeared in the LA Times.
The origin of the article was I had a tweet thread that went viral where I tweeted saying that we needed to talk about how there were segments of the evangelical community where the only thing Roy Moore did wrong was initiate sexual contact with girls who were 14 or 15, because there are segments of the homeschool world, especially where courtship involving 14 or 15-year-old girls and adult men is not entirely uncommon, and it's not something that would be frowned on.
Yeah, that just absolutely blew me away. I you know, people make fun about people south of the Mason-Dixon line in this particular area, and perhaps sharing a little bit too much DNA when getting married and all of that. But, you know, for the most part, I just assume that that's sort of ribald humor. But you're saying that, at least as far as the age gap goes, that this is something real that takes part in some of these cultures, eh?
Right. Right, and I think it's not necessarily, it's not a Southern thing as much as it is like sort of a fundamentalist Christian thing. In the late 80s, early 90s, in the homeschool community started pushing some of the leaders started pushing the ideas of courtship and betrothal instead of traditional dating relationships. And the idea is that women are ready for marriage, or girls are ready for marriage, when they are able to take care of a home, keep a family running, take care of children, cook, clean, whereas men are ready for marriage when they're able to support a wife and family And because in those homeschool communities, girls, by the time they're 14 or 15, have those skills to run a home, because there's a lot of large families where the older daughters are expected to help with the child rearing. They're considered prepared by that age, whereas men would be considered prepared when they're older, since they have to be able, financially capable of supporting a family. And that young kind of idea of courtship and marriage spread without into broader evangelicalism through Josh Harris's book, I Kissed Dating Goodbye. So by the late 90s, early 2000s, that idea of courtship, instead of which is a parent-guided, parent-directed relationship with the intention of direction towards marriage, kind of suppressed dating in a lot of the evangelical world. So even though in those evangelical churches, which wouldn't necessarily support child marriage, they do push the idea of marrying young, that married 18, 19, 20 years old should be married instead of marrying after college. And so the idea of kids being, or girls beginning courtship when they're in their middle teens is not as big a jump as it would be in mainstream society.
Yeah, and you include this quote from Duck Dynasty star Phil Robertson. Apparently, he advocated for adult men to marry 15 and 16-year-olds. And he says that, let's see here, if you wait until they get to be 20 years old, the only picking that seems to take place is in your pocket. What's the first part of that? That he says, if you're marrying at 15, they're picking something else. I don't have
that. The context of the picking, and that was picking ducks.
Picking ducks. So that's
like
right.
Plucking. Yes.
That's it.
So yeah. So it's kind of the folksy down home framing of child marriage,
which is very offensive. I mean, essentially, what this culture is looking for is to maintain the status quo of woman only as mother and homemaker, that other options just will not be available. Is that fair to say?
Right, that's correct. And they base it on kind of a kind of a revisionist history, suggesting that child marriage was and young marriage was common in the past, which is actually not historically accurate. So it's a kind of it's a vision of a world that never actually existed.
I would have thought that perhaps, I think somebody tried to defend Roy Moore by saying that, well, look at Joseph and Mary. you're really stretching when you have to pull a comparison like that to defend the alleged behavior of Roy Moore. But I mean, I seem to remember, for instance, that like Romeo and Juliet were supposed to be like 15 years old, that Mary and Joseph were probably in their teens. So I'm assuming that and people's life expectancy wasn't all that great, you know, hundreds, perhaps thousands of years ago. So I'm assuming that at some point, people married much earlier than they do today. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Actually, this isn't my area of expertise, but talking to historians that I know who specialize in history of childhood, the child marriage in a Western context is actually relatively rare. We know about it in a lot of reasons because those cases were exceptions. such as in royal families, marrying to unite dynastic ties, where they marry off children for those purposes. But those were kind of unusual because they were so young. Even the Romeo and Juliet story, that's kind of an unusual story precisely because of the ages of the characters involved. So in a way, they've taken these stories that are, they're kind of the exceptions that prove the rule that very young marriage didn't happen a lot, and have twisted it or misunderstood those historical examples and literary examples to see it as something common, which I know even my grandparents married at 19 and had to go in the 1929 and had to go from Pennsylvania to Maryland to marry, because I believe at that time you had to be 21 or a woman had to be 21 to marry without parental consent in Pennsylvania. So the idea that it's been kind of a long ongoing thing is not really historically accurate. I believe the average age was in the 1800s is 22 for men and 20 for women.
Sure, that's a little bit better than 14 yeah. or 15.
Yeah.
You say that when you grew up, you actually witnessed flirting between older men and girls. Now, would this be something? Yes. Would this be the kind of behavior that people? You said even church leaders. Would that be something that would be acceptable in society? Because you talk about courtship. Now, courtship is rather formal. You said it's parentally guided, and if memory serves, there's virtually no physical contact. I mean, like even a kiss on the cheek or something. If people are involved in courtship, do I have the correct picture? You to tell me if I'm wrong.
Right. Courtship, it varies, but it tends to be at most hand-holding, and often that's only after engagement. So it's interesting because there is that kind of courtship where it's very chaste, or it's defined, they see it as very chaste, even though it's when it involves girls who are that young, it's very much grooming. But then at the same time, because those girls are seen as kind of adult temptresses, that idea of sort of men who are adult men flirting with teenage girls or ogling teenage girls is kind of seen as it's the girl's fault that it happens, because they must be leading, must be the temptress or must be the one who is leading these adult men on, either because of their actions or because of how they're dressed.
Yeah, I actually read once in a very conservative Catholic publication, beyond the mainstream of what you'd read in other Catholic publications, that this woman was writing an editorial, and she was, in essence, she wasn't defending priests who molest children, but she was saying that there's some responsibility to be placed on the shoulders of the children who were engaged in that behavior. I was absolutely stunned. But really, from what I recall, in a lot of history, women tend to be blamed for being victims of any sort of sexual impropriety, including rape.
Right. I mean, historically, under English common law, it was assumed that unless a woman basically fought up to the point of death, that it was really, that she really wanted sexual assault. There is that. That's in broader Western culture, I guess broader culture period, where there's a sort of patriarchal, male-dominated cultures, women are blamed for their behavior and are expected to maintain that chastity no matter what.
And if, unfortunately, they do fall victim to a sexual predator, then they're just branded and often considered undesirable because they're no longer virgins, they're no longer pure, regardless, even if someone was to acknowledge, yes, it was the man's fault, nonetheless, we're still left with a woman who is less than pure, and that's a great shame upon all of us, really, in our society.
Right. And in a lot of, like, the evangelical context, even now, there's a whole lot of victim blaming. And there's victim blaming happens a lot in broader American society as well. But even when it's relatively young girls, it's still they are seen as responsible. They must have been dressed immodestly, or they must have done something to lead the guy on and to tempt him.
Sure. Catherine, we're out of time for this week's episode, but we have more questions and would love to have you join us next week if you can.
Sounds good.
And for people who are interested in reading more about this particular subject and others that you've written about, you have your own blog, correct?
Yes, I blog at catherinebrightbill.com.
And that's Catherine with a Y in the middle there.
Yes, that's a K and a Y, K-A-T-H-R-Y-N.
Okay. Well, Catherine, thank you so much, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. Please join us again next week for another edition of Common Threads.